Fishing itself was a quiet affair. It had come to Kemp that he would be tempting fate to make a show. In the event, there was just father and son and a few bystanders and the people of the shipyard to see her into the water. Kemp had champagne served at the dockside, and he made a short speech, thanking the men who had worked on her. They cheered him with full throat. He had always been popular with them, and it was known that he had dealt generously with the widow of the man who had been killed and the family of the disabled survivor. There was the customary silence as the last of the scaffolding was removed. The shores knocked away and the ship eased up from her blocks. She seemed at first undecided whether to settle again. Then she moved massively forward down the greased slipway, the timbers that cradled her keel moving with her. For those few moments she glided resplendent, all below the waterline new-painted white, her clean plank above shining with resin, her mainwells and the lettering of her name picked out in dapper black. But she lost this gliding grace when she touched the element she was made for, ducking her rear into the dark water, wallowing there while the timbers of her cradle, freed at last, floated up alongside. The last Kemp saw of his ship was the Duchess, yearning away from him, as the Liverpool Merchant was towed out, stern first, into midstream, where her masts would be fitted. It is true that on the eve of her sailing, he would stand at the dockside, peer across the misty water, see, or have the illusion of seeing, the masts and spars of his ship, where she lay anchored out in the pool. But this was any ship now, a shape become generic, universal. His last real sight of her had been that swanning glide, that brief, ungainly wallowing, that yearning retreat of the figurehead. It was the last of her he would ever see. Part 2, Chapter 10. Matthew Paris's last night on shore was spent at an inn in Water Street, not far from the docks. He had called earlier at Red Cross Street to make his farewells, declining all hospitable urgings, deeming it easier for himself, as for his patron, if he did not impose himself for such a short stay. His wish was for solitude. More of his uncle's ardent prophesying he did not feel able to endure, and he might have been constrained to show it. He was ready for the voyage, as far as concerned physical readiness. He had the bare wardrobe he thought would suffice, together with his medicine chest, instruments, bandages and dressings, and a large store of medicaments and drugs. Not knowing what to expect, he had brought everything he could think of, from mustard to eucalyptus oil. In the lacquered box his aunt had given him, he had his writing materials, and in a larger one of tin plate, lined with wood, his books, which, for reasons of space, were few and carefully chosen. Pope, Maupertuis, Hume, Voltaire, these four he had rescued from the bailiffs, who had taken almost everything else. On the fifth, Astley's new collection of voyages and travels, he had spent some of his uncle's money, having been assured that it was a mine of information for anyone wishing to learn about Africa. Alongside these, in that same stout box, was the unfinished translation of Harvey's Treatise on the Movement of the Heart and Blood, which he had begun in prison, when, with his uncle's help, he had been able to afford a private room. Books were a habit, and so a need. But whether or not to include Harvey was something he had hesitated long over, caught in a contradiction he could not resolve. Stepping onto a slave ship, sailing with her, was as near to cancelling his former life as he felt he could come. And that was what, when he interrogated himself, he believed he most wanted. He wanted to cauterize the nerves that held him to the past. And yet he had not felt able to leave Harvey behind. Ambition? The wish for some lustre to fall on him from this great and revolutionary work? But how could that live in one breast with a desire to kill the self, to smother it in darkness, a desire so urgent at times that it came to him like an impulse of violence? And why, in spite of this, did the past lie in ambush for him at every unguarded turning of his thought? His desolation bristled with such questions, like blades. There were reasons more immediate, and these also he gave weight to. The voyage was likely to take 8 months at least, and he did not expect to be occupied with medical duties for the whole of the time. There would be vacant hours to contend with. 8 months, he thought, sitting at the window of his upstairs room, looking out at the light rain which had just begun to dampen the cobbles. Perhaps longer, perhaps a year, all according, as Thurzo no doubt would say. Perhaps in that time, among those new scenes, he would become somehow different. But it did not seem likely. He felt fixed forever in his shape, impervious to change, whatever lay before him. It seemed to him that he had reached this final shape quite quickly. A few random blows had been enough. All the years before, his studies, his practice, the happy years of his marriage, he had remained unformed, impressionable. He had thought of himself as flowing towards something in a kind of pursuit. Quite suddenly, this had been reversed. He had become an object of persecution. Was this the rescue, this shape of stone he was now? Those in pursuit did not turn to stone. Only the pursued were wrought into shapes beyond change. In the late afternoon, he had writing materials brought up to him, and sat down to write a letter to a friend and colleague in Norwich, to whom he had entrusted his collection of fossils. All he had, really, to leave or care about. He hesitated for a little while, looking from his blank page to the thin slant of rain outside. He had said goodbye before he left. This was a mere indulgence of his solitude. Almost he decided not to write at all. Then, with an impulse of impatience, he dipped pen and ink and began, "My dear friend, I write on the eve of departure to say my farewells over again, and to thank you once more for all your acts of kindness towards my Ruth and myself." A blurring of his page obliged Paris to pause here, though, having only just begun, gratitude to his friend released tears in a way that thoughts of his wife could not. Her name in his mind was all desolation. Clear-eyed again now, but with throat painfully tightened, he resumed. "I do not in the least know what awaits me on this voyage, and though this need not at all distress you, my dear friend, and I am not seeking to make a parade of it, I am quite indifferent to what becomes of me, at least so I think at present, though if it came to a danger to my person, I dare say I should scramble with the rest, that being our nature. If I should not return, please keep, for your own use, the collections you have been kind enough to house for me all this while. They are all I possess of any value. I mean to say by this that you should keep them whatever happens, and regard them as yours, since even in the unlikely event of my ever returning to Norwich, I shall not want to set eyes on them again. They would recall the past too painfully. I hope the specimens will be of use in your own investigations, and in particular those preserved parts of sea animals by which we learn of the changes of place in the waters which otherwise could not have been supposed. I am giving up the work, because it belongs to a part of my life that is over now forever. But I have not changed in my convictions. I could only recognize one vital principle throughout animate nature. By natural gradation of species, we must always be led to an original species, and this must be the same for man. Though life may appear very compounded in its effects in a complicated animal like man, in my view it is as simple in him as in the most simple animal. I think we have reason to suppose that there was a period in time in which every species of natural production was the same, and this could square with the account of creation given to us in the Old Testament. But over great spans of time, and with the earth and water changing situations, there have been many sorts of transmutation. It is not true, as they said, that I denied God's creation and promulgated atheistical notions, but I cannot agree, my reason will not allow me, with those who would have us believe in a fixed, immutable species, or in successive acts of creation and extinction. Self-contempt had been growing steadily in him, and he ended abruptly with good wishes and renewed thanks. As he chalked the page dry, He was swept by a despairing sense of his incorrigible vanity and folly. Even now he could boast of his constancy, could stand up on the ruins of his life and crow with his doctrines like some vainglorious cockerel on a dung-heap. He had maintained an abstract truth and published it abroad at the expense of all that was dear to him, and he sought still to make it a cause of pride. It was appropriate that dry bones and dead beetles should be his only legacy. The rabble set on by the church party had smashed his press and thrown his furniture out into the street, but by an unerring instinct of contempt, they had ignored the cases of fossils in his study. "If I could have the choice again," he thought, "if I could keep my Ruth and the child inside her, I would make any grovelling recantation. On my knees I would confess to all error since time began." But this was another proclamation from the dung-heap. If he could not claim all truth, he would embrace all error, never the common mixture of mortality. In shame, he would have torn the letter across, but checked himself. It was well that Charles should know the specimens were for his unrestricted use. He would be more cautious in that use, since such was his nature. He would continue to collect evidence, make his observations, write notes. But nothing would be published until he was safely dead. Some day, these obscure researches that men all over Europe were making would find a synthesis in one brain, and then the age of the earth would be stated boldly, and it would be shown how the creatures had changed. A little later, when it was getting dark, he went out and walked towards the pierhead. The rain was still falling. He saw a woman lying sodden against a wall in a fume of gin. One or two tap-houses showed gleams of light, and he saw a farrier, hunched at work, still inside his shop, but the streets near the waterfront were for the most part deserted. Paris stood in the rain, looking towards the open sea. Lanterns of ships out in the road winked through the moist air. The Liverpool merchant was there with the others, riding on the dark water. For some moments, as he stood there, the night was hushed around him. There were only the winking lights across the water and the silent rain. Then he heard the running of the tide, the scream of a late seabird, voices raised and lowered again from a tavern further along the quay. He tried to think of Africa, tried to imagine the lives of Africans, lives that would be changed, more even than his own, by the ship. But it was too far away. There was only the rain on his face, the sense of solitude. The door of the tavern opened. Two men came out and stood talking there. In the yellow light from the open door, the rain had become suddenly visible. Paris saw the glint and swarm of it, and without warning was transported to summers of his childhood. Insects round lamps at night in the garden, or over river water in dying sunlight, rising and falling as regular as breathing in the last warmth of the day. The door closed. The bright swarm was extinguished. But the vision of those lost summers remained with him, like the sum of all loss. Standing there, looking across to the lights of the ships, one of which was to take him to a future of sorts, Paris could think only of the past. Chapter 11. Seated in his cabin, Thurso listened with satisfaction to the sighing and creaking of his ship as she felt the movement of the tide beneath her. She was a good one. He knew it. The sign had been given. The seal of blood was on her. He looked for some moments without speaking at the faces of the three men he had asked to step up here. Barton, he knew of old. His second mate, Simmons, sat opposite, directly under the lamp. He was younger, with fair hair and calm blue eyes, and a nose that had been broken once and mended badly. Haynes, the boatswain, was brawny and dark-complexioned, with a mass of oiled curls and glittering, close-set eyes.
"Now listen well," Thurso said at last. "It is but a few words I have to say, but I want them remembered. As you know, we are all but ready for sailing. We are light of some of our salt beef still, and all the fetters have not been taken aboard, but that will be seen to shortly, and then we need wait only on the wind. I don't want any of the crew mistreated in the meanwhile. They cannot be allowed off the ship, but they can eat their fill, and while we're in harbor, they can be served a half pint of grog per day for each man. No more, or they will fall to fighting. Keep them busy as far as possible, but there is to be no use of the rope's end till we are under way and out past the Black Rock.
The harsh whisper of the voice ceased for a little while, and Thurso seemed to consider. When he resumed, it was on a note that seemed intended to be more jovial.
I don't want any of the beggars jumping overboard and swimming for it, as I have known happen on other ships. Whether they sink or swim, it is the same loss to us.
He paused again, looking closely at each face in turn. An old, disconcerting habit. Raising a thick forefinger, he said,
"Anything untoward, and you will answer for it. That is all I have to say, gentlemen. Mr. Barton, you will stay behind, if you please."
When the others had gone, both men relaxed in their different ways, one moving less, the other more. Barton shifted in his seat and raised a narrow, watchful face.
"I have done you proud for a cabin, Captain Thurso," he said. "Hauk panels, mahogany table."
"Don't you concern yourself with my cabin, Mr. Barton. I can see for myself how my cabin is appointed. My cabin is not in your province."
"No, sir, of course not. Only remarking."
Barton risked a note of humorous alacrity, only possible when he judged his captain to be in the best of moods, but his eyes had narrowed at the rebuke, and there was nothing humorous in their expression.
"You keep to your side of things, and I will see you all right,"
Thurso said.
"You can leave the sea for good. You know what that side is, don't you? You will do my shouting for me when we're at sea. When we get to the Slave Coast, you will go upriver with me, and you will deal together with me for the gold dust on the proportions we have agreed, and you will say nothing about this private dealing to any man, either aboard ship or on land. You keep to this, and I will see you all right."
"You know me, you know Barton, we have dealt this way before."
"Aye," Thurso said grimly, "I know you well. Take some brandy. You know me too, don't you? You know the Guinea coast too, don't you? If you don't keep faith, you will not see Pool Lane again, nor the ladies of Castle Street. You will not dip your wick there again, I tell you."
Barton made no reply to this, merely swallowed some of the contents of his glass, then worked his lean jaws appreciatively.
"This is an excellent brandy," he said. "First class."
"Never mind the brandy, damn you. You're getting too familiar. This is my last voyage, as you know. I intend to run a tight ship, same as always. Better than ever, for the last. Try to abuse your position, and you will soon discover that Thurso has no favourites at sea. Aye, sir."
Thurso raised his head.
"I feel her straining," he said. "She's pulling at her moorings. I'm going to take care of my owner's profits, too, same as always. I will trade on the best terms I can get."
He kept his head raised, as though listening for something from the night outside. Light from the lamp lit his heavy brows, but his eyes were shadowed.
"He sets me on again," he said. "I will do my best for him, same as always. It is in my compact."
Barton, who had been regarding the abstracted captain with a look of stealthy dislike, said,
"What compact is that, Captain Thurso?"
"Never mind. Never mind. I have kept my square. I'm still here."
"Some owner he is," Barton said after a moment. "He's all over the place. Still, we have taken on a fair mix of cargo. I will say that for him. He has ordered everything just right for the trade."
Kemp had been diligent in this, as in all else, and he had taken counsel. In these last few days, in addition to victuals, they had stowed away muskets, flints, gunpowder, glass beads, iron bars, bolts of brightly coloured cottons, bales of taffeta and silk, gold-braided cocked hats, knives of various sorts, copper kettles and basins, casks of brandy and rum, 500 looking-glasses. Together with this were articles not intended for sale, whips, thumbscrews, branding irons, and a quantity of manacles, fetters, chains and padlocks, all of good substance and well wrought.
All the same, Barton said, two Negroes privileged for a second mate, that is unheard of. That is carrion philanthropy beyond what is warranted.
Thurso drank and mused, head lowered now. He had a way of removing his attention, as if others were no longer in the room with him. The tide was on the ebb. He had felt the change in the way the ship rode at her anchor. The lamp was turning through a slight arc, and light from it moved over the oak panelling, which still smelled of varnish, and over Thurso's lowered head, and the suddenly indignant face of his first officer.
"No, it ain't right," Barton said. "He could give something to the carpenter or the gunner. They are valuable people aboard. We know what a second mate is on the Guinea run."
Thurso raised his head and fixed the other with a sombre stare.
"Don't you concern yourself with that," he said. "Who knows where the second mate will be, or the gunner, or the carpenter by the time we reach Jamaica? When were you last on a ship that brought all her crew back from Africa?"
"Then there's a doctor,"
Barton said in the same tone of indignation.
"Relative of the owner, never been to sea before. What the jig is he doing aboard of us?"
"Aye, there is something there," Thurso said. "There is something pressing on him that he might be ready to talk of to the right man. Try to smoke him out, Barton. Do it friendly-like. You will know how." "I will do my best."
Barton looked earnestly at the bottle.
"My level best, Captain Thurso. Have some more brandy. After that, I will require you to go ashore."
"Tonight?"
"Aye, tonight," Thurso said irritably. "Are you afraid you'll melt in the rain? The sailing has been posted for 3 weeks now, but we still have only 22 men signed. Homeward bound, with the blacks discharged, it will not matter if we are light, but we cannot set out with less than 25. Take Haines along with you. He looks a handy fellow. See what you can find along the waterfront."
"Can I take a third man in case of things turning out unreasonable? Libby, say, him with the eye patch. He's friendly with Haines. I see them talking together."
"Mr. Barton, I'm surprised at you. Set an ordinary seaman on a slave ship to press men onto the same ship. There'll be blood all over the deck before we're out of the Formby Channel. From the officers they will take it, not from one of themselves. No, if you and Haines need help, you'll have to pay some scum there to help you. You can split up, if you like, when you get ashore. Get back here about 9. I will leave Simmons in charge, and we will go over together to see what the posters have done for us. You'd better stir yourself. You and Haines stay sober, or it is on your head, you being the senior. We need more crew, Mr. Barton, and it is a matter of indifference to me how we come by them."
Chapter 12. Half a mile away, and half an hour later, a seaman in a medium state of drunkenness named William Blair was entering an obscure alehouse in a narrow lane close to the docks. He had been paid off 2 hours previously after 8 months at sea. In those 2 hours he had travelled some 300 yards from the edge of the water. He was in his best shore clothes, still had most of his money, and was poised precariously between jollity and truculence. As he swaggered up between the tables, he tripped over feet that hadn't been there before, and stumbled slightly.
"Stow them trotters, bonny lad,"
he said, more for the sake of dignity than anything else. Blair was always careful of his dignity, which led him sometimes into quarrels. He was short of stature, but very quick, and he was fearless. The man thus addressed made no answer, but he kept his feet where they were. Looking down, Blair saw bright, dark eyes set close together, and a bitter mouth. Most of the man's face was shadowed by his hat, which was high in the crown, varnished and polished, in sailor's fashion.
"Well,"
Blair said, coming up to the counter, brushing the rain from the front of his buff nankeen jacket,
"still guns on spittin'. I wish to God it would rain and be done."
The landlord was bald and corpulent, with a greasy apron and an impassive face and dull brown eyes.
"Yes," he said, "that is looking at it one way, but a drizzle is good for trade, brings them in. And I think it's good for this trade. All weathers, you can't have gone wrong, man. Give us a gill of best Jamaican and let us see you fill it up. Hey, Scotch!"
The voice, rudely peremptory, came from behind him as he was taking out his purse to pay. He knew without needing to look that it was the man whose feet he had tripped over. He noticed another man, in a long, ragged cloak, go out through a door behind the counter, but thought nothing of it, being again concerned with dignity, which did not allow him to glance round. It did not permit him, either, to put away his purse other than very slowly.
"Ignorant," he said regretfully to the landlord, loud enough for the other man to hear. "The majority of persons learn to tell the difference between their arse and their elbow, but there will always be them as can't. There's a class of lad that will still gun on trying to shit through his elbow joints." He listened for the scrape of a chair, some sound of movement behind him, but heard nothing. He drank deeply, felt the heat of the rum in his throat and chest, knew he was on the way to getting good and drunk.
"I'm for Sunderland," he said loudly. "Gie us another of you, please, landlord. A exact copy."
The landlord nodded. His eyes had been on the purse and its contents, and on the pocket to which it had returned.
"Just off a ship, are you?" "Docked this afternoon. 75 days from Caracas. The brig Albion, Captain Josiah Rigby. I'm bloody glad to be off her. The first mate was a cannibal in human form."
Blair fixed the landlord with a belligerent stare.
"If we meet ashore, I will spill him out," he said.
The ragged man reappeared, and a few moments later two young women came in laughing together, hair wet from the rain. They came directly up to the counter.
"Going to buy us a drink, me chock?"
"I will buy you a drink," Blair said handsomely. "Billy Blair is not a man to say no to the ladies, but don't get up your hopes, as he is not proposing to gang on with it all bloody night long."
"Speaks pleasant, don't he?"
the same woman said. She had an Irish accent, hair the colour of pale carrot, and a pretty, anemic face, darkly bruised on the right side, over the cheekbone.
"I like a well-spoken man," she said. "You can keep those foul-mouthed gits. Gin, please, Captain. How about you, Bessie?"
"This here's Bessie. I'm Eve."
"Gin," Bessie said.
"Gin for the ladies, rum for me," Blair said. "By God,"
he added to no one in particular, and passed a hand over his face.
"It goes down on the slate," the landlord said. "No need to pay every time round. In this type of occupation, you gets to be a judge of human nature. You gets to know who you can trust."
"Sure, it is not often you find an open-handed feller in these parts," Eve said.
"What about these parts?"
Blair leered and pointed down at himself. Eve uttered some high, mirthless laughter.
"Well, I don't know, do I?" she said. "What parts you hail from, Billy boy?"
"He's a wee cockalorum from Scotland."
Blair turned to meet the dark, close-set eyes and thin smile. The man was still sitting sprawled there. He had taken off his hat, revealing a mop of black ringlets glistening with oil. He was strong-looking, with broad shoulders and thick legs.
"You again,"
Blair said. His hand strayed a little towards his right hip.
"Been curling your hair, haven't you?" he said. "Bloody scuthead."
"Take no notice, darling Billy," Eve said, pressing close against him.
"I will mince him up," Blair said with extreme ferocity. "I told him once I ain't a Scotchman."
"Have another drink," the landlord said. "I will stand it. It's not often I take to a man. We got meat pies in the kitchen, prime beef."
"You," he said to the seated man, "you hold your gab, or you'll go out on your arse."
The place was more crowded now. The woman called Bessie had gone off to join some others round the table. Billy allowed himself to be pacified. He had more rum and a plateful of pies. He was having some difficulty now in seeing clear across the room, and was tending increasingly to reduce the range of his focus. Standing up close against him, Eve gave him a gentle squeeze of his balls.
"Full of grape shot, them,"
Billy said boastfully, through a mouthful of meat pie.
"England's finest."
He had taken a definite fancy to Eve, with her blue eyes and delicate pallor of underfeeding.
"Some bastard been clouting you,"
he said, looking at the disfiguring bruise on her cheek. She laughed on the same high, careless note.
"I was running round in circles and I bumped into myself."
"Have you somewhere we can go together, just the two of us?"
"I have got a love nest all me own, darling Billy. But let's have a dance first. Let's have a bit of fun, for God's sake. We might all be dead tomorrow, Jemmy, mightn't we?"
This had been addressed to the landlord, who agreed with every appearance of fervour.
"Where the devil is the fiddler?" he said. "Where is Sullivan?"
The cry was taken up by others. Several people wanted to dance, it seemed. The fiddler was found in a dark corner, sleeping with his head on the table. Roused, he came shambling out into the centre of the room, clutching fiddle and bow, a tall, ragged figure with glinting stubble on his cheeks, a dark shock of hair, and dazed green eyes that seemed lately to have looked on wonders and to be glancing after them still.
"Give us a reel!"
somebody shouted.
"I'll not play without a drink," Sullivan said. "Never a note."
"Give him a drink!"
"I seen you before,"
Billy said.
He steadied himself against the counter, took a careful pace forward, and looked closely at the long face and beautiful, bemused eyes of the fiddler.
"We was on shipboard together somewhere," he said. "Michael Sullivan, always arguing."
He paused for a moment, swaying slightly. Then he had it.
"The Sierra, Captain McTavish, about 5-6 years ago. Cargo of hides from Montevideo. Am I right or am I wrong?"
Sullivan paused a long moment, as though gathering his wits.
"I was on that ship," he said. "I will not say that I wasn't. It was you done all the arguing, not me. McTavish was forever blaspheming."
"Dead now. You have done it on the bottle."
Feet planted for balance, Billy looked proudly about him.
"By God!" he said. "There can't be many that has a memory like Billy Blair, drunk or sober. Blair is razor sharp. You remember me? Come now, you can't have forgot Billy Blair."
"I do and I don't," the fiddler said. Some change had come over his face.
"Listen, Billy," he said, "you don't want to be dancing. 'Tis an idle pursuit, and the Pope has frequently spoke out agin it as leading to all manner of sins."
"What's wrong with you?"
Billy screwed up his eyes in order to see the fiddler's face better.
"Why are you switching your lamps about?"
"Steer yourself, Sullivan. Give us a reel," the landlord said.
"What do you mean by talking?"
"You need another drink," Billy said. "Once a shipmate, always a shipmate with Billy Blair. Gee us your horn, man. Have you followed the sea since?"
"I followed the devil. Listen."
But then Eve was standing close again, and there were two men between Billy and Sullivan, one of them he of the ragged cloak.
"Stir your gab,"
this man said roughly to the fiddler.
"Come on, Sullivan, darling, give us a reel," Eve said.
After that, events became confused in Billy's mind. Sullivan made no further attempt at conversation. He played "I'll Away No More" at a brisk pace and followed it with "Sweet William." There was dancing. The small space was crowded with people jostling together. Eve laughed a lot and touched him intimately. The drink and the dancing had brought colour to her face. After a while she excused herself with a tender smile.
"I'll just be away for a piss, darling," she said. "I'll be with you again before you can shake your peg."
But she did not come back. And this defection changed the quality of everything in a strange and sudden way. The fiddle fell silent. There were fewer people in the room, and these only men. The landlord's looks grew sullen and disdainful. Billy was sweating and asked for ale, but this came slowly, and when it came was sour and thin. These various factors combined to turn his mood ugly. Such sudden lowerings are difficult to take with equanimity, even for milder temperaments than Billy's. It is one thing to know that pleasure is fleeting, youth ephemeral, and the grave just round the corner. It is quite another to have it brought home to you all in the space of 5 minutes.
"What choplash piss is this?" he said. "You have served me with the washings of the casks!"
And he splashed the rest of his beer down onto the stone floor.
"Now that was the act of an out-and-out swine," the landlord said. "I see I was mistaken in you. You can pay up your score and get out. There is 3 shillings and 4 pence on the slate." "That is robbery, you fat bugger," Billy said. "If I come round that bloody counter, you'll be right sorry. Where is Sullivan? Shipmate, let's you and me cast off from here. I've got money, I would stand treat."
But it was precisely at this lordly moment that Billy found he had no money, none at all. The purse was gone from his pocket. And when, in the shock of this discovery, he looked at the landlord's face and saw the ugly complacency on it, he knew with that power of divination that descends on the cheated, instant and terrible, like a dark afflatus, that from the moment of walking into this alehouse he had been among actors.
"My purse," he said. "That Irish crack has stole me purse. We could catch her yet before she gets it to a scully."
He made a movement away from the counter.
"No, you don't," the landlord said. "Cover the door. What purse? I never saw no purse. Anyone here seen a purse? Catch hold of them, lads."
He had started round the counter. Two men moved on Billy, one from either side. He put a hand to his hip pocket, but the knife was gone too. Drink and shock had slowed him, but he had time to throw his tankard into the first man's face and hear it strike against the teeth, time to take 2 steps and land a hard kick on the landlord's kneecap.
He was staggered by a wide-angled blow to the side of the head, evaded another by some instinctive cunning of the body, struck back and missed, slipped on the wet flags, recovered. A body fell against him, and he struck at it, only to realize it was on its way floorwards anyway, and not by his doing. He took another jolting blow to the face. Someone caught at his arms from behind.
"Well, my mannequin, how goes it now?"
Billy could feel blood running into his mouth. Someone was groaning behind him. There was a man lying on the floor. Through a bitter film of moisture, he saw the smiling face of the man who had baited him. He had a gold band in one ear and smelled of coconut oil.
"Scuthead!"
Billy said. He made a violent effort to free his right arm so as to strike at the face before him. Without ceasing to smile, the man gave him a blow in the stomach, which cut off his wind completely.
"All right,"
he said when he could speak.
"I'm done. Let me sit down."
"Scuthead, is it?"
the other said softly. His eyes were shining. With the outer edge of his hand, he gave Billy a light, almost casual blow across the bridge of the nose, blinding him with tears. When these cleared, he saw that the man on the floor was Sullivan. There was blood in his hair.
"Give the fiddler a sousing,"
someone said. Billy did not see this done, as he was hauled off now into a smaller room and seated on a stool. The same two men stood beside him. One of them had a badly split lip, he noted with satisfaction.
"There's yin plug I'd earned a shilling," he said.
His right eye was half closed up.
"Now then, Billy boy," the dark-complexioned man said, "we have had our little difference. It is a simple enough matter I have to put to you. My name is Haynes. You'll get to know me well. I am bosun on a fine, new-built ship, and we finds ourselves needing one or two likely lads. Now, you are a likely lad, and no mistake, a fine little strutter you are. You owe money here that you cannot pay by any manner of means. Where are you going to get 3 shillings and 4 pence, darling Billy? You signs for the voyage, all fair and square, or the landlord calls the officers and lays charges agin you. There's plenty of people to swear you never had no purse when you come in. He will swear debt and assault agin you, and he will put his heart into it. You have near crippled him."
Billy spat some blood onto the floor.
"I'm right sorry to hear that," he said.
He was caught, and he knew it. What Haynes was telling him was an old story.
"I walked in the wrong door, didn't I?" he said. "That gang of thieves shears out my purse. You pays the score here and docks it out me wages. What manner of ship is she? Where's she bound? You are never a bosun of a navy ship."
"What difference does that make?"
"If she is not a navy ship,"
Billy said slowly,
"she must be a guinea man. You wouldn't get up to this for an ordinary merchant vessel." "Well, my game cook, which is it to be? It will be proved agin you, never doubt it. You will go to prison till it is paid, and how long will that take, my bantam? Men have died in prison for the sake of a shilling. You've been in prison before, Billy."
Billy looked at the bosun's face. The narrow-set eyes were observing him with close interest. There was not much cruelty in Billy's nature, and it came to him now, with naive surprise, that Haynes was getting pleasure from this. Spattered with blood as he was, and still half-dazed, he had his dignity to think of. He sat up straight on his stool, gripping the sides for balance.
"Blair is the name," he said. "It is only me mates call me Billy."
Not very far away, in Mount Street, Daniel Calley came in from the rain. He had been working since first light, carrying sheep carcasses and crates of fish up from the quayside to the top of the market in Stone Street. He had 9 pence in his pocket, and he was wet through and hungry. Also, in an obscure way, he was distressed. As usual, the bargemen and stallkeepers between them had cheated him, and as usual, he had not been able to understand how. The shift to symbolic modes of reasoning, the essential transfer from concrete to abstract, normally occurring in the course of childhood, had never occurred at all in Callie's case. He could not work out what was due to him. He puzzled at it as he toiled back and forth, but the figures would not lodge in his head. Sometimes he was driven to ask, but he could not understand the glib explanations. He would clench his big fists in misery, not so much at thoughts of the money, but at being derided and treated unkindly. A simple sort of joking was the best way with him then. The men who cheated him knew that. Like a child, he could be confused and softened by jokes, But a wrong word to Callie when he was excited or disturbed could have dangerous consequences. He entered the pothouse where he usually ate when he had money, and often slept. They let him sleep in the yard, in a little covered space behind the chicken coop. He took off leather harness and back pads and fish-slimed apron and shook the rain out of his hair. He was squat and very muscular, broader in the nape than the skull, so that his head was tapering and blunt, like a seal's, a resemblance that the rain, by sleeking down his brown silky hair, had made more obvious. In the close, low-raftered room he gave off a steam of wet clothing and sheep's blood and fish oil, enriching the effluvia of boiled mutton and stale beer, already resident there. He asked the serving girl, whose name was Kate, and who was 14 and had one leg shorter than the other, to bring him mutton broth, all the place offered. While it was coming, he thought about his entertainment for the rest of the evening. He knew the cost of certain basic things, and on his fingers he could balance accounts. He knew he could have his mutton broth and then some treacle tart from the pastry cook's on the corner. He was fond of sweet things, and that Kate would come out into the yard with him for two of his pennies, and that he would still have enough for a pancake next morning. These thoughts were producing a simultaneous salivation and erection when a man came and sat at his table, a tallish, wiry, sharp-featured man in a blue pea jacket and wide-bottomed trousers, and with his hair in a pigtail.
"Clammy night," this newcomer said. "Keeps on raining, don't it?"
Callie smiled but said nothing. He was always shy with strangers. The saliva of his anticipations made little stretching webs at the corners of his mouth. His eyes held an unchanging radiance, as at some remote delight whose source was long forgotten. He had a complexion a woman might have envied, clear and pale, without the smallest blemish.
"I got wet," he said.
"Aye, did you so?"
The stranger cast a brisk eye over the harness and the thick leather pads against the wall.
"Been portering?"
The broth arrived, and Callie launched a noisy assault on it.
"I've been working in the market,"
he said between mouthfuls.
"I see, it does give you a appetite. You must have got 2 shillings at least for every day like that."
Callie looked up defensively. Some of his earlier feelings of frustration and distress had returned, but it did not occur to him to lie.
"I got 9 pence,
he said.
"What, you have been labouring all a livelong day with a saddle on you like a horse, and you gets 9 pence for it? I can scarce believe my ears."
"I ain't a horse," Callie said.
"That is a utterly pernicious state of affairs. It is scandalous."
The stranger was looking round the room and shaking his head in amazement. He had a peering, sniffing way of seeming to interrogate his surroundings.
"It is enough to freeze the marrow in a man's bones," he said.
Callie rested his spoon in his broth.
"You saying I am a horse?"
"You're a man, and a fine strong one, and good-looking. I'll wager the ladies is after you, ain't they? Lining up for it, ain't they?"
"Kate likes me."
"I dare say she does, and who would not? I have took you myself. Here, try this."
The stranger drew a bottle from the capacious side pocket of his jacket.
"Take a swig of this, and tell me if you've tasted a better brandy."
Callie drank, and the liquor coursed through him, bringing with it the knowledge that this man wished him well.
"Good brandy,"
he said. The stranger drank and smacked his lips.
"Nectar of the gods," he said. "Here, have some more. That's right. What's your name?"
"Dan'l,"
Callie said shyly.
"Tell me, Dan'l, what's a man like you doing, slaving up hill and down dale for a few pennies? You are not a horse, but they are saddling you up like a horse. They are working you like a horse, see what I mean?"
"Kate comes out in the yard with me,"
Callie said. He did not want this new friend to think that his portering was the only thing about him.
"And well, she might. I expect you show her a good length, don't you?"
A moment of inspiration came to Callie.
"Like a horse," he said.
He saw with delight that the other was laughing at this, and he began laughing too.
"That's a good un. Listen, I have duped to you, and I want to do you a favour. I am mate on a fine new ship that is bound for Africa, and I have got the idea that I can obtain you a berth on her by exerting my influence with the captain. I wouldn't do it for everyone, but we are mates, ain't we?"
Callie smiled. His mouth shone innocently with mutton fat.
"That's right," he said.
The mate pushed the bottle over.
"Have another swallow," he said. "Africa, there's a place for you. Sunshine, golden beaches, as much palm wine as you can drink. Trees loaded with fruit, thick with it. All you have to do is reach up and take it. I'll tell you, it is an earthly paradise. And a woman, big gob, they are hot."
He kissed his fingers with an extravagant gesture and a smacking sound, very fascinating to Callie.
"Sable Venus," the mate said. "They will do anything you want. Hot, they are always on fire. It is the diet, all them peppers. It is the climate. It is their nature."
"Sable Venus," Callie repeated softly. Neither of these words meant anything to him, but pronounced together they had a deeply suggestive sibilance that fell on the ear like music. He drank some more from the bottle.
"What will they do?" he said. "I am going to tell you something now that I have verified from personal experience. They have got these highly developed muscles in their cunnies. They can fuck you just by squeezing. They are trained up to it from earliest infancy."
He paused for a moment, observing the effects of the brandy. Then he said,
"You can try them women if you want, Dan'l. Why don't you come along with me? You get 25 shilling a month and your victuals. You can leave that harness standing there against the wall and come along with me. You will stand up like a man. You will not go creeping about with a saddle on your back."
"Not like a horse."
Eagerly, Callie waited for his friend to laugh again at the joke.
"I've got 2 legs, not 4, he said.
The mate got to his feet.
"Let's be going then," he said. "You needn't fetch and carry for them bastards any more."
Callie got up too, caught in a wave of enthusiasm.
"Them bastards," he said, "they can carry their own sacks of turnips."
"No more sheep guts for you," the mate said. "They can get someone else to do it."
"Someone else can do it," Callie said.
He was still laughing, but rather uncertainly now.
"You come along with me. I will see you all right."
But the mirth had left Callie's face, to be replaced by a look of anxiety.
"No," he said, "I can't come now."
He felt unhappy to be disappointing his friend, but he had thought suddenly of Kate and the treacle tart. Barton was a sensitive man in his way, and he had noted the change of expression. He put an arm round Callie's shoulders.
"I'll tell you what," he said. "We are only out in the stream. You come along with me now and look the ship over. If you don't like what you see, you can be back again within the hour."
The knowledge that Deacon was worth money had been in Jane Britto's mind for some time, but she did not know that she intended to sell him until he spoke of leaving. She had been waiting in the cellar where they lived for her husband and Deacon to get back, standing half stupefied in the steam of washing and the gasping cries of the baby in her ears, and no drink and no money to send out for any. But it was only when she heard them that she felt the clutch of rage at her throat. First came the scrape of their boots in the alley above, then the clatter down the cellar steps. The two of them came through the door, filling the low room with their voices and bodies. Perhaps the rage sprang from this, the intrusion, though there was little here she could have wanted to defend, in this dank place with a mangle and tub against the wall, smells of rank bacon and tallow fat, the sick baby, the two children squabbling together on a mattress in the corner. But there is no world so wretched that it cannot be violated, and Jane felt her body stiffen as she looked at the two men. They were wet and smelled of drink, and Britto was jovial and Deacon, as usual, serious. This much she took in.
"What have you got for us to eat?"
Britto said, almost as soon as he was inside the door.
"Me and Jim is famishing, ain't we, mate?"
He was a stocky, dogged man with bad teeth and steady eyes and too much suffusion of blood in his face. The abruptness of his speech she knew for a sign of failure. They had been looking for casual work on the docks.
"Me and Jim is famishing," she repeated with a sudden strident mimicry that astonished them. "Me and Jim is a pair of pisspots."
She would have liked to go on longer in this oblique, ironical vein, but rage got the better of her. Her voice rose and shrilled.
"Proud on yourselves, are you? Think you're men? Where's the rest of it?"
The smile left Britto's face. He looked uncertain for a moment, then angry.
"Where is what?" he said. "What are you talking about?" "The money, what you have kept back from your family. The pennyworth of juniper juice, what you have brought home for your wife." "We didn't find nothing,"
Brito said sullenly. He glanced at the silent man beside him, but found no support there in the tanned face, the serious, reckless eyes.
No good looking at him. You'd do better to look at them.
She motioned violently towards the mattress in the corner, and at once, frightened by the gesture or by the prospect of blows to follow, the white-faced little boy and girl began gasping and crying.
You trollop! Stow your noise! I ain't got nothing to give you!
Anger at being obligated to state the fact thickened his voice. He took two steps towards her.
You loud bitch, he said. You better mun your dobber. My arse!
She felt rage and fear together. He was not less likely to strike her with the other man there.
Where'd you get the drink, then? Think I can't smell it on you?
We went uptown,
Deacon said in his light, dispassionate voice. We were Old Norse's heads for some gentry. They gave us threepence between us, and we drank it. He paused briefly, then, in the same tone, said, I'll be leaving tomorrow. Early morning. He was taken by surprise himself at the announcement. He had intervened only to avert a row, but the main decisions of his life had been like this, recognitions of some truth, something self-evident that had to be acted on. Davin, he said, that's where I'm going.
Well, there's a piece of news, Jane said. More than 2 weeks you've been here taking up space.
Once, in that time, when she had been drinking alone, Deacon had come back in the afternoon, and they had laid together on Deacon's pallet, and coupled without tenderness, and she had clutched at his hard body and felt the welts of old floggings on his narrow back.
"Then you go waltzing off," she said, "without so much as a kiss my bum."
Her rage was rising again, directed now at Deacon's uncluttered life. Casually, just like that, he could walk away, disappear, and the money with him, she thought suddenly. Within half a minute of his leaving, the price on him would be lost to them forever.
"You leave him alone," Brito said. He's got the right to go when he likes.
But she could tell that Brito hadn't known either.
Don't you talk about rights, she said. What is it to me that you were shipmates? Very fine, isn't it? He's run from a navy ship, you tell me he can stay here. You does the favour, I gets the extra work.
The idea expanded steadily in her mind while she was talking. It might be as much as £3 that Deacon was worth. For tuppence a day and keep, she could get a girl to mind the little ones. She could buy a grinder, get scraps from the butcher, make sausages and sell them in the street. There was profit in sausages. Perhaps they could save the baby.
Little place called Sheetwash, Deacon said. That's where I am going.
No one's asking where you're going.
You aren't asking, but I am telling you, he said mildly. I was born there, see? And I've not been back since I ran away when I was 12.
You've done some running in your time, she said bitterly.
She paused, looking at Deacon's composed, fair-browed face, the remote blue eyes that always seemed to look beyond people. The intention to sell him had come to her like sudden hope and blossomed with her rage. Without rage to keep it fresh, she was afraid it would wither.
Never bring a penny in, she shouted. Catch a few bloody fish in the river. I'm killing myself with this mangle. They're calling me a whore in the court because I've got 2 men in here, and you spent it all, didn't you? Call yourselves men!
Brito moved towards her. The voice of the little girl on the bed rose in remonstrance or fear. The woman moved back sharply, felt round behind her for the long-handled pan on the stove.
Keep off, she said. The baby's sick, she said. It can't hardly cry any more.
A storm of weeping shook her suddenly, even while she felt for a weapon.
I don't know, she said. I don't know. You could have brought a drop of gin back.
Brito went to the crib in the corner, looked down at the bloodless, crumpled face, with its inflamed lids, the glaze of vomit on its chin. The baby looked up at him with an impersonal solemnity, its hands curled against its breast like tiny, shell-less crabs. After a moment, Brito turned away, raising his own hands in a clumsy gesture of helplessness. And he was again the man she knew, dogged and ashamed. She felt something like pity for him then. He had tried for work all day and come back to this.
It has got something wrong with its stomach, she said. It can't keep anything down.
She could not tell him what she was going to do. Not then, because she knew he would prevent her, and perhaps never. Not only because of the thrashing, but because such a hurt to his pride would make him unpredictable, and she was afraid he might leave her. She could conceal the money. She could say it came from somewhere else. She would think of something.
You gone out again? She said, looking at both men. "Not me," Deacon said. "I'll get my gear together. I want to get an early start. Not that I've got much," he added with a faint smile.
"There's cockfighting over behind the Pickerel," Brito said. "I had a hand in training two of them. The owner might put something on for me."
She knew this indirectness meant he wanted to go, but would stay if she liked. The look of the baby had softened him.
"What's that, then?"
10 o'clock. They're fighting our birds first."
"You go," she said. "You might win something." Brito grinned, relieved at her change of tone.
"I'll make a change. I'm going out to see about some washing. There's a bit of bacon and some taters in the stove. You could hot 'em up."
She put on bonnet and shawl and went out quickly without looking any more at Deacon. The Bell was the inn named on the poster. It was a mile off, but the rain had stopped now, and the moon rose clear in the sky. At the inn she was directed upstairs, where she found two men at a table.
"You the ones taking on crew for a slaver?"
"That's right, my pretty. 100%.
The man who answered her was sharp-faced and smiling, and had an alert, peering sort of way with his eyes.
"Liverpool merchant," he said. "A spanking new ship that anyone would be proud to sail with. Only we ain't taking any ladies on, not this particular voyage."
"Mr. Barton, you go too fast," the other said in a hoarse monotone.
He was in a grey wig and a stiff blue coat with brass buttons, and his cocked hat lay on the table before him.
"You're the skipper," she said.
"I know where there's a man for you. I can tell you where you can find him. Once you get a hold of him, you can't choose but go. He's run from the Navy."
"Has he so? Been treating you badly, has he? You tell us where he's put into, my dear. We'll take him off your hands."
"I can take you," she said. "I'll show you the place. If we was to go now, we'd find him on his own. How much will you give me for him?"
"Able seaman, is he? Fore the mast? Sound in wind and limb, is he? How old is he?"
This hoarse questioning caught her unprepared. She met the gaze of raw-looking blue eyes. They were small in the dark red square of the face, and they held no kindness for her.
"About 25, she said. "I don't know. He's been on and off ships most of his life. I want £3.
"If we can secure him, and if he has got all his arms and legs attached to him, we'll give you £2. That is the going rate, and that's what we're paying."
"Oh, that's a good 'un. Arms and legs,"
the other man said.
"I want £3.
The man in the wig sighed harshly.
"Explain to the woman, Mr. Barton," he said.
"My pretty, I'm afraid you do not understand the finances of it. To take in hand an able-bodied man, what has his full complement of arms and legs, and what doesn't see eye to eye with you as to the tack he should follow, and is inclined to be disputatious, that needs 3 stout men. Them men has to be found, and them men has to be paid, and that pay has to come out of the price. That leaves £2 for you, or there's the door."
She had not wanted to think about Deacon, but now something resigned about his face came into her mind, and she remembered the scars she had felt upon his back. Her resolve did not change, but the composure that had sustained her so far began to break at last. She felt tears gathering. She wanted gin so badly now that she could hardly keep her limbs still.
"Blast your livers and your eyes," she said with a sob. "You neither of you worth him pissing on. I get guineas, for God's sake. Get me 2 guineas for him."
Having assembled his few possessions, and made a bundle of them, Deacon lay down on the pallet in the narrow space against the wall at the far end of the cellar. The damp from the wall came against his face. He heard a catch of breath from the exhausted baby. The children on the bed were silent, perhaps sleeping. He began to think about the next day. He had no money and no plans, no sense even of a likely sequence of events. All his programme was imagined sensation. The silent street he would step out into, dawn coming slowly over the tips and brick kilns and dirty pools on the outskirts, then the open fields, and himself moving through luminous spaces with the sun rising and the fields filling with light, and himself always moving, unimpeded, totally free and yet awaited. He knew the impossible ambition of the escaper to find welcome horizons. He had not been back for 14 years. He did not know if his mother was still alive.
He wanted now to know. She had pleaded for him, as far as her fear allowed. Whether his father was alive or dead, he did not care. He had a memory of the place he had started from, as simple and brightly coloured as a child's picture book. Soft green folds of hills, lush grass, red earth, brindled cows grazing knee-deep in buttercups. Embedded in this, like a splinter, was the stone farmhouse on the Coombe side, the dark little shed where his father locked him up after beatings for tasks neglected or badly performed, though this was a dark mystery, as the beatings came regularly, in spite of all effort, and pardon did not depend on anything he could do or say, but had to be wrought by the darkness of the shed, sometimes an